And we are back. Mary, it's so good to see you. It's just been 4 months since our last episode.
It seems longer somehow.
Doesn't it? I feel like so much has happened in the world to do with climate. It's crazy. It's almost like the minute we turned our backs. I mean, I also, every now and then, I kind of see you popping up on social media and I think, oh, I can't wait. I hope we get another series.
There is an awful lot to catch up on.
Yeah.
And so many significant climate reports, which we'll have to delve into. And new movements launched and new political commitments, both broken and made.
Yeah.
But before we do, I think we better remind people, Maeve, what we're up to.
Well, okay, in case people have forgotten who we are, which I doubt. I am Maeve Higgins. I'm a writer, I'm a comedian. And today we're taping in New York City, which is my adopted hometown. And about me, well, I like to mix it up. I work on serious content about immigration here in America. And also I make a very serious podcast about romantic breakups.
Well, I'm Mary Robinson. I'm the former president of Ireland. And I am trying to convert Maeve into being a genuine climate expert.
Yes, and you're doing a really good job. And I
Well, you're a slow learner sometimes, but we're making progress.
Look, do you know that the hole in the ozone layer has basically been fixed?
Well, that's really important because that was the world coming together very effectively.
Yes, that was me. I fixed that.
No, Maeve, no, you didn't. But I'm glad you know about it.
In this series, Mothers of Invention, we explore ways in which climate change, despite being a man-made problem,
has a multitude of feminist solutions. In every episode, we introduce our listeners to the inspirational Mothers of Invention who are leading the charge with solutions to climate change all over the world and hear their genuinely incredible stories. Now, all our guests today will help us understand all these new developments. We're meeting incredible women leaders who've been in this fight for over 20 years and others who aren't even 20 years old, a 13-year-old. They come from Botswana, from Chad and from the United States.
Mary, I want to say, you know, congratulations to you. Since we last saw each other, you are now the chair of the elders. You've been a long-term member of the elders. And in case people don't know, the elders, I mean, this is what I know about you guys. You know, the elders, they're old. They know a lot more than you could ever dream of knowing. Your brain is broken because of Instagram, but the elders don't even care what people think of them because they're so old and cool. Is that the vibe?
Well, I prefer to say that we were brought together by Nelson Mandela and Graca Machel in 2007. So we're not that long. We've marked our 10th anniversary last year.
Yeah.
And it was to carry on his vision, his legacy. Our first chair was Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And when he retired, and even retirement is not full retirement, you become an elder emeritus or an elder emerita if you're a female elder.
They never let you out.
Not quite let out. So Archbishop Tutu still from time to time can contribute.
Yeah.
But we had a new chair, Kofi Annan, and I was with Kofi on his last mission in July in Zimbabwe, pushing himself on behalf of the people of Zimbabwe, having a cold, his voice had gone, and then he got pneumonia and complications and died. For him, he died on the job. For the rest of us, we were bereft because it was so sudden.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so sorry because I know, of course, he meant so much to so many people as a sort of a leader, but he was also a friend and still doing this really important work.
Hmm.
And so did you all meet then and you talked it through and you were like, I'll step in, I'll step up, I'm ready? And
it was more, I was very keen to persuade one or two other elders that they might step up, but the buck stopped with me, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And the other thing that happened in the meantime, remember I was an aspirant giving up meat. Now I am a full-blown pescatarian.
You are?
Yes, which means I no longer eat meat, I only eat fish.
Well, that's fantastic. I know everybody's been wondering, Maeve, what have you been up to this whole time? I have a few things coming up. I'm the lead in this film. It's a comedy film, but it got into the competition at South by Southwest, and that's in March, so I'm just kind of killing time until then.
Is that the one that you were talking about? It's an Irish film, is it?
Yes, it's an Irish film, and it's an unofficial biopic of your life, and Nick is played by Scarlett Johansson. No, it's about a lonely driving instructor. So I'm a little busy, but I know that you're extremely busy. You have this suitcase that you never unpack and you're traveling all the time. So how are you going to have time for Mothers of Invention season two? Should I put out a casting call for other ex-presidents and climate legends?
No, I'll always have time. I must say, I've been really impressed by the impact that a podcast can have.
There are thousands of podcasts, but I want to say congratulations to us because the Podcast Brunch Club, who are this bunch
of... Who are they?
They're like a bunch of podcast aficionados. And they got in touch with us to say they declared us their cutest couple of the year. Isn't that cool?
As I said, it is not about us, Maeve.
I know, but we're so cute.
The way to get the climate justice across. And interestingly, climate justice has hardly been out of the news for a day since our last episode a few months ago.
Yes, and I do think that there is like a pushback from citizens. Like, is it just because I've only kind of tuned in the past year?
Look at the elections that took place here in the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of those women and women of such diverse backgrounds, that was so exciting. And of course, many of them are so young to me, as you can imagine.
Yeah, but they're young, it really is good.
And they feel passionate about not only averting a climate crisis, but also putting the United States back in a leadership role. We badly need that.
Yeah, and there's an even stronger grassroots climate movement too. People like Extinction Rebellion, I was learning about them.
Yeah, that was very interesting. I was in London several times and they were blocking bridges.
Yeah.
You know, at weekends on a Saturday.
Yeah.
And willing to be arrested. You know, real peaceful protest, but willing to pay the price. And, you know, quite a number of them were being arrested. I mean, not everybody has to do that, but I admire the fact that they are so committed.
Well, it's exciting because that specific group, Extinction Rebellion, they're starting actions here in New York too. I might just like watch from the sidelines because I don't want to get arrested because I'm an immigrant.
Well, I understand that. Maybe you're half brave. That's okay.
You know Maeve, she's half brave. So I'm trying to think what else is going on with me. I got my fringe back.
Mm-hmm. Does that matter when you're doing podcasts? Nobody can see you?
That's true.
And in the climate justice space?
Oh, well, there was another COP meeting, a follow-up to the Paris Agreement. This time it was in Poland. And one girl in Sweden has kicked off a worldwide school strike for climate action. So let's talk about these school strikes that are taking off everywhere. A 15-year-old began a solo climate protest by striking from school in Sweden in August 2018. Her name is Greta Thunberg, and since then, almost 70,000 students each week are holding protests in 270 different towns and cities. And I love this idea. Like, if I could have thought of any reason not to go to Double Maths, which for me was always on a Friday, this would have been it.
Maeve, that's not the point. You should never miss maths in particular. These young people are striking with banners that are saying, what's the point of learning when the government isn't listening to experts? Mm. And, you know, they do have a good point. It's their future.
Yeah.
The strikes spread so quickly that Greta was actually invited to speak at the big climate meeting in Poland, the COP, in November. It was just wonderful. I'd love to hear her again.
My name is Greta Thunberg. I am 15 years old and I'm from Sweden. I speak on behalf of Climate Justice Now. Many people say that Sweden is just a small country and it doesn't matter what we do. But I've learned that you are never too small to make a difference. And if a few children can get headlines all over the world just by not going to school, then imagine what we could all do together if we really wanted to.
She's right. This is what I've come to the conclusion as well. It's up to people everywhere now to make this personal. What's really happening is, you know, Greta is not alone. The largest protests have actually been taking place in Australia.
Thousands of school students have staged protests around the country demanding greater political action on climate change. Students defied the Prime Minister's calls to stay in school. The protests were inspired by a 15-year-old Swedish girl who pledged to protest outside the parliament in Stockholm until the country caught up on its Paris Agreement commitments.
And the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, was urging students not to take part and telling them to be less activist.
We do not support our schools being turned into parliaments. What we want is more learning in schools and less activism in schools.
Well, let's hear from these Australian strikers. Yeah.
My name's Manjot Kerr, I'm 17 years old and I'm from a country town of Mudgee.
My name is Nosrat Fariha and I'm a high school student from the southwestern Sydney region.
growing up in high school, I was just always aware that climate change was a big issue, and I'm not sure where I picked it up from.
My parents are immigrants from Bangladesh, a country that is undoubtedly facing the devastation of climate change. It wasn't something that my community talked a lot about, nor did my school.
Watching politics, I started to get concerned because I realised the leaders that I was relying on and waiting for were not taking the action that I was expecting.
These leaders, they have to create laws that not only protect themselves, but us, and they are actively failing to do that.
When the school strike started, I knew that was something I wanted to be a part of because I fully believe in the power of young people to make change. I realised that I needed to step up and kind of make use of my own platform and my own voice.
It's the future Australians, the ones that can't even vote yet, me and Manja and so many millions more. We didn't choose our leaders. Our parents did, adults did. We're holding them accountable. You're ignoring the future of this country, and we will not stand for it.
In my community, growing up in Mudgee, almost all of the people have some sort of connection to the mining industry. We really need to keep that new perspective on how we can reinvent our communities to still be successful and sustainable.
March 15th is just the beginning of our fight, and we plan on doing so many more initiatives and meetups and training sessions to fully spread the message of climate justice and climate action, which should be taken immediately and should be made priority by all of our influential and government leaders.
You know, what I love is the fact that Greta mentioned climate justice and it was so natural to her. And yeah. In Australia, these young people are saying climate justice.
Yes.
They know that that's the way forward.
It's so cool, right?
Yeah.
You are the first person I heard using that word. I think you're like a teen influencer, Mary.
Well, I wasn't the first, but I do believe it is the way because it brings in the injustice mm-hmm. and the fairness issue.
And you know, I'm really happy to say that these strikes, like these kids that we're hearing from all over the world, they're happening here in New York as well. And we have a guest who's going to come into the studio to talk to us, Alexandria Villaseñor. She's a teen activist, and let's welcome her.
Absolutely.
Hi. Great
Thank
to
you
see for you,
Alexandria.
Having me.
Sure.
Alexandria, you're very, very welcome. And I think you're probably the youngest person of our Mothers of Invention. So
really?
For that too. And I believe you're 13, is that correct?
Yes, I'm 13 years
okay.
old.
And
yeah, you're definitely the youngest. Is it rude to ask like who our oldest guest has been? Do you know?
Could be me.
Anyway. Mary's 142 years old. She looks good though, no?
See what I have to put up with, you know?
Thanks for coming in today. Now, we should say we're taping on Martin Luther King Day, so you probably don't have school anyway, is that right?
Mm-mm. Nope.
So we've been listening to Greta. I'd heard her at the COP in Poland when she spoke so well.
Yeah.
But you'd obviously been listening to her too. When did you first hear about her? When did she first make an impact on you?
Well, my hometown is Davis, California.
Yeah.
And so I was visiting there when the Paradise Fire broke out. And so my family had to fly me back out to New York. And of course,
Why did you have to leave Davis?
Because of all the smoke. Because my home was only an hour away from the fire.
Oh,
so
wow.
We got all the smoke coming in.
What was it like?
It was very scary. No one could leave the house. There was people who were still going outside because they didn't realize like the smoke can be damaging to your lungs.
Could you see it?
Yeah, it was hazy outside.
And did you wear a mask some of the time if you had to go out?
Yeah, I did.
Hmm.
But there were people in downtown Davis who were dropping from the smoke, from smoke inhalation.
Hmm.
Ambulances were coming by. And so they had to fly me back to New York because long exposure is harmful.
Yeah.
So once I got to New York, I was very upset about that because that's my hometown.
Hmm.
All of my friends are there, family. And so I started looking up because the fires aren't normal. That's for one thing. So
yeah, there's always wildfires in California, right? That's like part mm-hmm. of the sort of climate there. But in the past few years, they've been much more deadly, much more unexpected.
Yeah.
And it's in your time.
Yeah, it is. My generation is going to have to learn to adapt in some way.
Hmm. And So you became an activist, and how did that happen?
Well, I saw Greta. I started seeing her interviews, her speech at COP24.
Yeah.
And she said, you should go strike in front of your parliament or somewhere of importance.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I mean, the UN was one of the most influential places.
And of course, you're here in New York, so the UN was
there. Right here. Yes. So yeah. I just decided to strike that Friday, and it just started a chain.
And what was the reaction of your parents? I mean, you were missing school.
They're very supportive. Mm-hmm. They understand it's a major problem that we're going to have to deal with. And so they understand that I want to strike to raise attention to that.
So when you say you strike, like, what does that look like? You get up and you get your like flask of water and your backpack and you have some signs. I've seen photos of you out there. And that's it. You just go and you sit in front of the UN?
Mm-hmm, till I'm frozen.
Well, which part of the UN exactly do you sit in front of? Is it the main gate?
Yeah, in front of all the flags. Okay. There's a bench that I just sit in every time.
Are you by yourself?
Yes, normally, but sometimes a few people will come by and sit down with me.
Mm.
But for the most part, I sit by myself. Mm. I try and look at the reactions of people walking by.
Yeah.
So I try and see if anyone pays attention to the signs, if they actually read it, or if it's one of those things where they see someone on the side of the street with a sign and they're like, don't make eye contact, just pass them by.
That's my method.
Yeah.
What do your signs say?
COP24 failed us and school strike for climate.
Nice.
Good.
Very direct.
Yes. You have to be very direct with the sign because you haven't much room.
Yeah. And so on March 15th, what's going to happen?
It is going to be a school walkout that here in New York, we are calling it the School Shutdown for Climate, where we are reimagining our future. All youth are reimagining our future in a climate-changed world. My chapter of Zero Hour, we are partnering with the students in Australia who are organizing their next big march.
Oh, we just heard from them, actually.
Really?
Zero Hour. That's this amazing youth-led movement. They're doing great work. They kind of train and organize young people here in the US. So it's funny, like maybe if you don't have a community in New York, like with your peers right now, you do have this global link with all these other kids in all these different countries.
Yeah, they all help each other out and we're all very supportive of one another.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important because we need to reimagine the world we want, you know, that future world. So it's very exciting that young people are, you know, galvanizing and I'm so happy about it.
What would you say to like all the young people that are listening to this show?
That our generation are going to be affected and impacted by climate change the most. We are going to have the most extreme weather.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to have to learn to adapt.
You know, I was with Kofi Annan on his last mission and he repeated several times on that mission that you're never too young to lead and you're never too old to learn. That's my bit. Never too old to learn. So actually, you know, you and others are young leaders now and we really, really need that.
Where can people find you, Alexandria? How can we support you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at AlexandriaV2005. And you can be supporting of the cause by coming to the shutdowns and striking every Friday for Fridays for the Future.
That sounds amazing. Thank you so much for joining us, Alexandria.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, sure.
I must say, I'm very impressed. I have a 13-year-old grandchild and she's not doing quite what you're doing. I'd be encouraging her.
You just got a child in Dublin in a lot of trouble with her grandma.
At the beginning of October, we had the new Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, the IPCC report, and it said very strongly that we basically only have until 2030, which at the time was 12 years. Now it's 11 years.
We've already lost a
avert
year.
Catastrophic change and reduce global emissions by 45%.
That really seemed to strike a chord of people.
What I found different about the report of the Intergovernmental Panel, the report was a very stark and interesting one because they were asked to tell us the difference between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees of warming. And what they said was that the Arctic ice melts, the coral reefs disappear.
They vanish.
And the permafrost.
Island communities, coastal communities
And the island communities will be inundated, will go under and will have to leave their islands.
Totally. And if we only have these 12 years to take action, I do think that's an even bigger challenge. But then there's people like, you know, the new president of Brazil, and he's chosen a foreign minister who believes climate change is, you know, part of a plot by cultural Marxists, which, Mary, is there something you need to tell me?
Well, you know, we're in a bumpy time.
Yeah.
With a lot of nationalism, a lot of politics is going in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
But the IPCC report has said this is global now. We all have to stay at 1.5 degrees. And that is going to be a huge moonshot approach. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like John Kennedy saying mm-hmm. we have to reach the moon and doing it in 8 years.
Yeah.
And they did.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, incredible. We need a moonshot approach now, not business as usual.
Hello.
Hi, Pauline. Pauline.
Hello,
how are you? This is Maeve, one of the presenters. And we're so glad you could join us.
Nice to meet you, Maeve.
You too. Mary Robinson is here too. Okay, we're going to go into it. So Mary's going to introduce you, Pauline, and then we'll get cracking into the conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
So the IPCC report concluded that we only had about 12 years to take action that really made people sit up and take notice. And I'm delighted to introduce our next mother of invention, one of the scientists behind that report. Pauline Dubé is a professor at the University of Botswana. The one thing I would say, yeah, Pauline, immediately is I'd love to change places with you right now because it's very, very cold here in New York. Mm-hmm. A bitter chill, a cold snap. And
oh, I would love to change places because it can be so hot here.
Is that right?
So hot. I'm wearing a hat right now.
Oh, dear.
You're wearing a hat. We're both wearing scarves. We're like sitting in the studio and it's so our cheeks are burning from windburn.
Oh boy, it's so hot. You can do something about the cold. You can't do much about the heat.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah.
Well, Pauline, it really is a pleasure to talk to you. And I wanted to begin by thanking you for your work over many years. I know that you've been a contributor to the UN scientific panel that we call the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, since 2001. And I believe that when the panel won the Nobel Peace Prize, you were one of those who received your award certificate in recognition of your input, which is very impressive.
Thank you. Thank you.
Where did you put the certificate? That's something I would flex on nonstop.
Where did I put it? I received it and I just put it behind my back until one day the UNDP wanted to celebrate.
Yes.
And my boss was surprised that I had that certificate.
Good, good.
And then I was surprised it became a big issue nationally. Otherwise, I just had put it underneath some card boxes. And I didn't
oh, for God's sake. I would carry that around. I would frame it and just be like, oh, I'm just back from the framers.
That's I did thing. That afterwards.
Okay, good.
That's enough, Maeve. That's enough.
Good, good.
So tell me, Pauline, how do you feel about how your report on the 1.5 degrees warming was received globally? Was it what you and your colleagues were hoping for?
Yeah, I saw that question that you're going to ask me that. But I want to begin by bringing my personal life that actually when we were reaching the stage where the report was being, you know, taken out to the public, I was caught up with, you know, what do you call it? The inequalities and disparities. I lost two brothers to diabetes on those particular moments.
Diabetes, that's terrible.
So I didn't participate as I should have. But I did go to the launch of the report.
I'm so sorry for the loss of your brothers. That must have been such a strange thing for this global focus to be coming on you and you were dealing with this.
No, it's not strange. It's part of the whole activity. I mean, I can begin just by my brother. The reason why my brother had diabetes is because when you get real drought and farmers mm-hmm. lose cattle, livestock, the stress that comes with that has got a health impact. And one of my brothers, it was so direct like that kind of thing. You know, they end up with blood pressures and they develop, you know, the cycle. Once you've got blood pressure, eventually it's the kidney, then it's the diabetes, and then it's death. Especially when you don't have very good medical system. Mm-hmm. So Botswana has always been a semi-arid area. So we did have drought in the past. But we feel that the droughts we have now are severe. And we also have surprising ones. we're getting more drying, especially in the southern part, you know, where the capital city is. So it is all very much linked, you know, when the report was in October.
In Korea, you know,
in South Korea. I attended that part, and there were difficulties. But eventually, I thought we all agreed that the report was worth what it was meant to be. I was just surprised about the COP24.
So that was the last big international climate meeting in Poland. That was following up after the Paris Agreement.
Yeah, it was actually, tell us more about your feeling about that. I was very disappointed that it wasn't possible for the COP to welcome your report because of the opposition of the United States and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. Tell us about how it felt. It must have been really disappointing.
No, it was, but not surprised. I was not surprised.
Yeah.
I usually said to my first world colleagues that the most vulnerable group to climate change is the developed world. We should be spending more time really figuring out scientifically how does the developed world get out of the, you know, carbon-locked economy. Because for us, our economies can still be flexible and be changed. Yours, they can, but with great difficulty.
That is so interesting, Pauline. You know, we've been doing this show. This is our second season. And that's not something that we hear all the time, that it's the developed world is going to suffer because we're the ones who are so addicted to and so reliant on all of these, like, you know, dangerous practices.
We really need to dedicate and looking at how do we assist the developed world systematically. Also because if you go for rapid mitigation, you know, you run the risk of bringing down the global economy. And when the global economy goes down, it is us, the poor, who suffer most.
Is there anything, Pauline, that's giving you hope in the climate space at the moment?
Give me hope. hey. It's hard, but there is a bit of progress. I mean, to reach the Paris Agreement, that was a really milestone for everyone.
I agree.
We all celebrated. Mm. Even though we have difficulties now, I think we have made a huge progress.
Well, Pauline, thank you very much for saying yes to us because we wanted to have women like you, scientists, you know, who have a real sense of the difficulties of the developed world as well as developing countries. I think that's an interesting comment that we hadn't heard before on the programme. Yeah. So many thanks for
And I liked the word mothers of invention.
Oh, yes.
Maybe that's what attracted me.
Good.
Cool. Well,
I mean, all the best.
Anyway, thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Great
thank
to talk
you
to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Next up, we're going to Chad.
Mary, this is going to sound like a joke, but the God's honest truth is the last time I went to Chad, it was to ask him to extend my credit line on my credit card. It was 2 years ago at a bank in East Harlem, and I checked the guy's name badge.
No.
And it was Chad, so I kept using his name again and again.
Not that place, no.
I know you don't mean that guy, you mean the country.
I've been to Chad. I went there with Oxfam some years ago when I was based in New York with my organization called Realizing Rights. We were doing work in African countries. We had a wonderful opportunity to meet with women who'd come across from Darfur and hear their stories.
Well, I can't wait to talk to our next mother of invention, Hindu Umaru Ibrahim, Mary, your friend.
She is a very good friend for quite a long time. She's a very special person.
So we're thrilled to get to meet her too. She's a young indigenous woman from the Imbororo pastoralist community in Chad. And I heard that she made a very powerful speech at the recent COP climate meeting in Poland. Hindu, can you hear us?
Do I understand that you're in Davos?
Yes, I'm in Davos. And then yesterday they tell me that both of you will be there. Then I'm like, okay, I will do it.
Oh, we're so delighted. You know, Hindu, I've heard all about you from Mary, who's a big cheerleader of your work.
I'd love to draw you out on, first of all, growing up in Chad and being part of the Mbororo pastoralist community there. Tell us about the community and what it was like growing up and how you became a young leader.
So being a Mbororo girl and growing up at the community and going to school have been a big challenge for me. Firstly, my community are a pastoralists who are nomadic, and that's also what linked our relationship with the environment very tight, because we depend from this environment and we found environment depend from us. So I found myself between my mom and my dad who left the community and then come to the town. And that was my big luck there, to get born and then to go to school.
But sending a girl to school would have been very unusual, wouldn't it?
Exactly. So my mom sent us to school and then she get rejected by her family and by my father's families. Because they say that, like, oh, you become crazy because your husband left to his nomadic life and then you're sending kids to school, even the girl to school. And then my mom said, like, yes, it's my girl, so I will send them wherever that I want.
Your mom sounds so amazing. And also it sounds like you had access that way to two worlds, because you were in school, you were getting your education, but you also had this sort of older way of life. How closely linked were these two worlds for you?
So during the school time, she sent us to school. And then during the break time, everybody go to the community. So that's why, like, I left with my grandma, where I know how to milk, how to sell the milk. I know how to do everything at the community. When I went to school, I have been discriminated against the other kids. So they're saying, like, oh, I'm smelling milk. I'm coming from the nomadic community. So no one wants to sit next to me.
That's horrible. You were like the little farmer girl. And
exactly.
They thought, yeah.
Yeah. But being a kid, I'm like, why did you do that?
Indu, what age were you when you reacted to being bullied?
Oh, I was about 8, 9. So that was the rejection. And then being a kid, getting rejected by others, that's horrible. That's hard. But when I get the age of 12 to 13, so then I realized that I'm so lucky. Then I'm saying, like, oh my God, I went to school. So then I saw how the other people are seeing us. So that was a big wake up for me. So then when I get like 14, I decided that to create the organization that now I'm leading. Firstly, it was for women and girl rights. And then I realized that I cannot talk about the woman without talking about the man. And then I cannot talk about the rights without talking about the environment. And then I found everything in my life was linking up.
It's so fascinating. You know, we talk to lots of other mothers of invention on this show, and more we're hearing about the need to integrate Western knowledge and education with Indigenous knowledge. Could you tell us and the listeners about your 3D mapping project?
So the only way for me is to show the world that those people who didn't went to school are able to know and understand the environment better than those who went to school, who have the PhDs, but who learn from them. We say we have a lot of knowledge, and those knowledge are only in our mother tongue. Many of them, like 90% of them, we cannot translate into English, French, Arabic, and others. So we took the 3D participatory mapping, and we call it participatory because we put the children who help learning about the environment and man, and then giving the voice to the woman.
And so you sort of collect oral histories, is that right? And in that history, it kind of includes clues about how to protect the land and like the Indigenous ways of doing things.
Yeah. So we say, like, 50 years ago, what was in this land? How are we using it? How we manage it? What was the biodiversity? Then we enter to the discussions to the young generation to say, like, what are you seeing now? And then we move to how we can conserve it and which one we want to translate to share with other peoples to get better adapt and mitigate to the climate impact. And which one we want to keep into the community because it's a big intellectual property right also.
And then, Hindu, tell us how you became an actual leader at the conference, at the COP, of the Indigenous community.
It was in the COP20, just I was participating, negotiating in the meeting, and then just my colleagues decided that to nominate me as co-chair. I came in the room and everybody, like hundreds of them are clapping, and then, oh, Hindu, congratulations. I said, like, what? They say, you are the co-chair. We nominate you. I'm like, oh, my God. So this is a big challenge.
Was that because you were the last person to come into the room? It was like, you're it. You have this really hard job now.
I mean, I'm always, when I came to the negotiation, I never leave before that the COP end. And then they say, like, Hindu can follow this item. So we have to put her as co-chair and then she can lead us.
And we're finding you now, but you're at Davos, the big economic. So what's your goals there?
In Davos, it's about the globalization 4.0. So for me, this one have to be different than others, because in Davos, there is 25% of the world GDP who are going to be in this conference today to tell them that they have to be environment-based approach, gender-based approach, and then inclusiveness of all the marginalized peoples who are left behind, like indigenous communities. And not participation just to give us voice, but we have solutions. So now is the time that they come back to the humanity, to the moral issues, and talk with us. So that's my message here.
Well, wow. Hindu, you have a great voice and a great grasp of the issues. Will you have a proper platform in Davos?
Oh, I get like two panels where I will be sitting and talking and giving them this idea. But I have an informal meeting with probably head of state where I will draw my my proposition directly to them.
Congratulations.
Davos is not my world, but, you know, there are powerful people there who need to change, and they need to understand that the whole system of the world has to change from the way they have it. So
it's completely not my world. Let me tell you, the first year that I came here, I become really like crazy. I get inside, I'm seeing people with suit, and then when you see ladies with heels and things, I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing here? I'm like in this zoo, you know, like IPs. then I say, like, well, I decide. I say, okay, those people are very disconnected. I have to tell them what the real people are and what the real people live, and then they have to change. This small world is not like the small box where they are in. Wear the black suits and all the expensive things. I will wear my African clothes and come and then tell them how we are living.
Well, thank you so much to Hindu Umaru Ibrahim. Hindu, wonderful to talk to you today.
Hindu, you are great and I'm so proud of you. And,
thank you.
Keep up the good work and just keep that voice loud and clear.
I will. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank
great
you.
To talk to you.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Hindu is so impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, she's an incredible leader and I must say really good at speaking about her roots and knowing her roots. Mm-hmm. And imagine standing up as a 12-year-old to bullying and forming an organization. I love it.
I wish I was Hindu.
Okay. I'm not doing too badly, maybe. I'm not doing too badly, you know.
Thanks, Mary. Mary, there's one thing I wanted to ask you about. This episode, the title is Nothing Happens Unless You Press the Button. And the producer mentioned she got the title from you, but where?
Well, it was a story that is true. And it was just after I had stepped down as President of Ireland to take up immediately the job of UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. Not even taking a holiday. I was that stupid.
And did you go like from a Friday to a Monday?
Literally. Not very clever. Anyway, I started in Geneva where the Office of High Commissioner is for my first week. Difficult week. Learned how hard the job was going to be. And then came to New York with Spride Rosny, who had been my special advisor when I was president. So we land in New York and we get into the UN headquarters and into the elevator. Yeah. Nothing happens. And after quite a pause, Bride says, Mary, nothing happens unless you press the button.
Okay. Okay. Got it.
And that was actually, you know, a little bit the reality of 7 years of other people opening doors, pressing buttons. And I didn't have to do any of that. And then suddenly.
So you're kind of waiting there.
But actually, it's a wonderful metaphor for what needs to happen now. Everybody needs to press the button personally on climate change. Make it personal. Do something. I've given up meat. People can do all kinds of things.
You know, I turned down 2 gigs, one festival in San Francisco, one festival in Ireland, because of the travel.
Good. That's.
But I was just like, no, I'm not going to do
but
that.
I admire that. Mm-hmm. I mean, my foundation has been offsetting my travel. I'm trying to reduce it, as you say, and use my voice.
Yeah.
But you're doing something because you're taking it personally. You're learning, Maeve. It's wonderful.
But I want everyone to know, yeah, I was invited to those festivals. It was my choice.
Anyway, it's time for us to sign off, and just to let people know that we are going to be putting new episodes out from now until the summer and making them as frequently as we can get together, Maeve, whether it's here in New York, whether it's in Ireland, whether it's in London, as
yes,
we've done before.
Yeah, absolutely.
We will meet again. Don't know where, don't know when.
So we've got future episodes coming. We're looking at things like the role of women faith leaders, women looking to create solutions around climate and immigration, which is a subject really close to my heart. We're going to be hearing more of Mary singing. I mean, what else is coming up, Mary?
Yeah, we'll also be meeting women involved in creating completely new economic models,
yeah,
and working to protect the oceans.
We already asked for and received lots of really good suggestions on social media for women who should be recognised as mothers of invention. So please feel free to nominate somebody. Find us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram at Mothers Invent.
Mothers of Invention is a production of Doc Society and is made possible by the support of our partners, the Climate Justice Resilience Fund, the Compton Foundation, the Wallace Global Fund, the Children's Investment Fund Foundation and the European Climate Foundation, and of course, our loyal DRIP crowd funders.
This episode was produced by Jess Search and Beedi Finzi. Our series producer is Thamali Kondikara. Our audio producer and mixer is Anne Pope. Our researcher was Jade Asante, who provided amazing croissants today. Our audio producer in Australia was Melinda Wink. Our consultants were Iris Andrews, Ed King, Suzanne Dhaliwal and Catherine Wilkinson. Our theme music is The Beautiful Water Fountain by Tune Yards, with kind permission from 480 and Marriage Records.